In February of this year, the Right Reverend John Packer, the Bishop of Ripon and Leeds, working with the Children's Society, tabled an amendment in the House of Lords to remove a number of child-focused benefits from the scope of something called the Welfare Benefit Uprating Bill. No one outside of government noticed, and probably lots of people inside didn't really notice either. The Uprating Bill, which is now an act because it was passed by Parliament, limits the rate at which various benefits and tax credits, things like Job Seekers Allowance, Income Support, Child Tax Credits, it limited the increase to 1% a year. Now, because inflation was set to rise at a much greater rate than that, what that means is that the spending power and the actual living standards of benefit claimants, among whom are some of the poorest people in the country, will be progressively cut. 43 Anglican bishops signed an open letter supporting the amendment, and that letter was published in the Sunday Telegraph on the 10th of March. They in turn were supported by statements from the General Secretary of the Baptist Union, the President of Methodist Conference, the General Secretary of the United Reformed Church, the General Director of the Evangelical Alliance, and the Roman Catholic Archbishop Peter Smith. On top of that, the archbishops of both York and Canterbury, who by convention don't sign open letters, both offered statements in support of the amendment and the Children's Society campaign. We released the story as an exclusive in the Sunday Telegraph, but it actually hit their website late on Saturday night. If you believe nothing else I tell you this afternoon, believe me when I say this, that late on a Saturday night, after a couple of glasses of red wine, the words, "Hello, I'm the politics editor at the BBC," on your mobile phone sober you up faster than anything I've ever come across. The story was huge. It was the main item on BBC News all Sunday and all of the other broadcast news. It was on the radio, it was on pretty much every broadsheet and newspaper and web outlet. Now, you need to understand that that amendment was not an attack on the integrity of the government. The amendment didn't say that all reform of the welfare system was wrong. It wasn't a wrecking amendment designed to trash the entire bill. It was a calculated amendment designed to change a bill. It was based on our analysis that the effect of the bill would be disproportionate on children and that a belief that children shouldn't be bearing the brunt of a government's austerity measures. Judging by the reaction, you'd have thought that the Children's Society had asked for the overthrow of the government. The backlash was significant. There were the usual facile comments questioning why the church was involved in politics, as though church leaders are the one group of people who should be excluded from participating in political and democratic processes. But there were also questions about the morality behind the intervention from church leaders, comments that the people in church clearly had no real experience of poverty, though obviously government ministers and newspaper editors clearly do, and accusations by many that the bishops had simply made up the figure of 200,000 additional children being pushed into poverty by this bill, ignoring the fact that we were simply quoting the government's own assessment. I think my favourite was still the Sun newspaper, though, who in the immediate aftermath of this story published a story saying that the bishops, because they were inexperienced in issues of benefits and welfare and poverty, had no right to comment. And then when they realised that the Archbishop of Canterbury had in fact been a benefit claimant in his past, changed their minds and said really it was just out of selfish interest that he was defending it and it was nothing to do with it at all. Still, one mustn't expect an aversion to hypocrisy to get in the way of a good Sun headline. So why am I telling you all of this? I'm telling you this to make a point, and the point is that welfare and welfare reform are controversial issues. What's more, they're hugely divisive issues in which differing opinions have largely been exchanged through megaphones and added a great deal more heat, perhaps, than light to this debate. So when I wade into this debate, I realise that I'm wading into quite dangerous territory. A lot of people here will disagree with what I'm going to say. Some won't think I go far enough in my criticism of what's going on, and some will think that none of my criticism is justified. But whatever you think, bear with me, and we'll see if we can get somewhere useful. One thing that the bishop's intervention made really clear was that this issue is being thought through and thought about at the level of values and principles. This is not about practical issues to achieve a commonly agreed outcome. The argument about welfare reform at the moment is fundamentally about the values and the way we believe our society should be shaped. The language we've seen from government and indeed from church leaders was the language of morality. The main claim of the government is that welfare reform is fair and that it is, and that they are doing the right thing by hardworking taxpayers by changing the UK's welfare system. Likewise, criticism of the changes to welfare have been couched in moral and values terminology. And the fact that it's being fought about at the level of values is what makes this issue so difficult. We can debate practical political questions because solutions are pragmatic, they're flexible, we can make compromises. The problem with moral values is that they're harder to dispute, they're more intransigent. When it comes to debate about these issues in the church, then the language of values and morality gets translated into the language of theology. We talk about issues of morality as the will of God and therefore immutable. That can sometimes put them beyond the normal parameters of political debate. This debate may be about changeable political issues like welfare reform, that the debate is happening at that more entrenched and difficult level of immutable theological conviction. For Christians, there's another issue as well. What we have to recognize is that there's never been a consensus in the Christian thinking about what the driving morality of state and welfare should be. At different times, if you have a little look at the literature over the last two centuries, thinking on issues of state and what the state should do has varied across a range from extreme antipathy towards any state interference in market processes, generally justified on the theological grounds of liberty, a paternal concern to alleviate the conditions of workers by legislation, generally on the grounds of responsibility, through to a desire to rehabilitate a rich, a social and communal life that was supposed to characterize Christendom, generally on the grounds of mutuality, to a full-blooded conviction that the state should do what the church has always done in that area, generally on the grounds of equality. So divergent views about the main principles of Christian thinking on this issue, combined with a debate about pragmatic politics couched in immutable values, I think has made this an incredibly divisive, difficult political issue at the moment. So that's a pretty long introduction to say why we've got to where we are and why we're in a difficult situation. I've got what's left of this seminar to try and shed some light on the debate and see if we can find some way forward. In doing so, there are two mistakes I want to try and avoid at opposite ends of the spectrum. The first is to suggest that there is only one correct way to think theologically about welfare reform. Christian thought is always embedded, it's incarnated in certain cultural contexts. And so thinking about these issues will always show some variability. That's why we've seen those different guiding principles in the past. And it's only right and proper when it comes to doing theology to expect that it will change. What we're doing now as we try and think about these theological issues is place welfare reform in a context of austerity and a global economic downturn and work out what today's answers and today's approaches are. So when it comes to the practical political outcomes of this debate, I think it's fair to say that there won't be only one answer that can call itself Christian. There's still going to be a divergence of views. So if the first trap is to avoid being too divisive and suggest there's only one correct view, then the second trap is to try to go so far the other way as to find to some consensus and end up saying something so platitudinous as to say nothing of any value at all. I am sure that if we all just loved each other a little bit more and prayed a little bit harder, that would be a great thing. But it's really not going to help this debate move forwards. So while I'm not going to suggest there's only one correct way to think about welfare reform, I'm most definitely going to suggest there are some very wrong ways of thinking about welfare reform. So here's what I'm going to do in the rest of the seminar. First, welfare reform is a means to an end, and the way we design our welfare system will be rooted in what we think the purpose of human life is. It's going to be rooted in notions of what it is to be properly human. So I'm going to give you a quick answer to the theological question of what it means to be properly human. That's just a little issue to get us started. Second, I want to think about some of the changes that have been made to our welfare system and if they actually embody that principle that I'm going to outline. Third, and this will be the bulk of what I'm going to say, I want to suggest that there are three different values that are undergirding a lot of our public and political debate about welfare system. And those three values are almost never articulated explicitly. And what I'm going to argue is all three of those values are Christian heresies. Finally, I'm going to suggest some of the ways in which I think the church might choose to engage in this work and some practical suggestions, if you like, for you to take away. So to get started, what's the concept of the human good that I think should undergird any idea of welfare? I think my starting point is that human life is fundamentally relational. We're born to live in community and in communion with other people and with God. We are made for each other and for God. This is a concept that perhaps has been richer in Orthodox Eastern thinking than in the Western Church. In writings of people like Vladimir Lossky, you find the suggestion that we should think of humans as less as individuals and more as a nexus of relationships. Who we are is defined not so much by something intrinsic to us, but is in part depend on how we interact with others and with God. Humans are intrinsically interdependent, relying on one another in a profound rather than a superficial way. And those webs of mutuality, of give and take, about generosity and graciousness are the ways that we need to define humanity and human community. A good society, then, is one where all participate and all contribute, exercising our God-given creativity and generosity for the common good. I think that's a decent starting point for a Christian theology of welfare because it's an idea common across a whole range of theological traditions, from conservative evangelical to Catholic social. It also gives us a slightly different starting point from some of the previous ideas that I've mentioned earlier about liberty, responsibility, and equality. Not that those aren't important, but that if we start from a new point, maybe we'll get a fresh perspective that will shed a bit more light. So what's happened to our welfare system recently? If a rich relational life of mutual self-giving love is the defining notion of what it means to be human and human society, how does that impact our thinking on the welfare system? How do some of the changes that have been instituted contribute to or undermine that rich relational life that they're supposed to engender? The changes we're witnessing to the welfare state now are some of the largest changes to welfare that have taken place in the last 60 years since it was established. There is a very fundamental shift going on. The government has stated that the aims and intentions of the changes are to incentivize employment and work as a way for people to support themselves and to streamline benefits so that there's a long-term reduction in the levels of welfare spending, making the system more sustainable. It's worth saying at this point that I don't think that all of the changes are bad, at least in principle. The idea of simplifying a welfare system so that users can understand it is surely a good one. I hope you're all aware of how many benefits are left unclaimed, and I have now no doubt that a lot of that is due to the complexity of the system. Simplifying it so that more money goes where it is needed can only be a good thing. And helping people back into work is also a good thing. The rich relational life I've talked about requires exchange. It's about give and take. Work can be a good thing. So there are some principles in the welfare reform that are to be applauded, even though we need to watch very carefully to see if the exact measures taken actually achieve those aims. Another thing to say is I'm not going to go through a blow-by-blow account of every benefit here, uprating bills, benefit caps, universal credit, and tell you what I think of each of them in turn. We don't have time, and it would be exceptionally dull. But I am going to briefly outline some of the cumulative impacts and say why I think they're damaging. But I don't want to do that in isolation. Welfare is one of the ways we care for and look after people in society. It's an element of a much wider set of economic policies that impact the poorest and most vulnerable in society. So what I want to do is look at welfare in a wider context for just a moment. First thing I want to consider is those wider changes in the economy, including benefits, tax credits, and how they impact upon people. And there are two things I want to highlight. Firstly, what's the impact on poverty overall? What will be the impact of the budgetary decisions taken to date? Well, and I'm going to take a child-centred perspective here for obvious reasons, working for the Children's Society. If you look at projections from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the number of children living in poverty will rise by 600,000 between 2011 and 2015. Under the Child Poverty Act of 2010, the government actually has a legal obligation to eradicate child poverty by 2020. However, far from eradicating poverty, the Institute of Fiscal Studies predict that 1.2 more children will be living in poverty by 2020 than there were in 2011. Child poverty is going to rise. Further analysis from the IFS has found that families with children will lose out disproportionately from tax and benefit changes, projecting that changes between 2011 and 2014 will cost the average family with children about 6% of their net income, compared to about 3% for working age households with children and 2% for pensioners. So the first thing to note is that that burden of tax and benefit changes will fall disproportionately on families with children and hence on children. And that will significantly increase child poverty over the coming years. Second thing to look at is some of the government's own figures on the distributional impact of its economic policies. Now, if you look at their analysis that they released with the 2013 budget, you notice that the richest 10% of people in the country are actually the hardest hit by the cumulative changes. But if you take that top 10% out, then what you see is that the cumulative impact is deeply regressive. And what I mean by that is the poorer you are, the more money you lose, the larger percentage of your income that you will lose under these changes. The poorest people, those who are least able to absorb the blow, are the people who are hardest hit by the changes that are going through at the moment. So let's have a little look at a children's perspective on poverty and inequality might mean for children's lives. A little while ago, the Children's Society looked at poverty among children through the lens of material deprivation. And what we did was we asked children and young people what items they felt were necessary to lead a normal life. And we constructed a material deprivation list to look at children's perspectives of poverty. If you like, it was a children's view of the stuff they need to get by. And what's interesting is the list that children and young people came up with had many items on there that they felt were needed that are actually items that facilitate relationships. It was about areas you could play with friends. It was about family transport so you could meet people. It was about family trips and an annual holiday or time together. When it came to personal possessions, they talked about clothes that they needed to fit in with their friends. Yes, possessions matter. I'm not going to tell you we're raising a generation of selfless non-materialists, but it's important to note that materialism is in some senses for another purpose, facilitating that rich relational life I mentioned earlier. Now, as poverty increases, so will the chances of child deprivation increase, so will the impact on children and young people's lives directly and indirectly through the impact it will have on those relationships that are facilitated by time together, areas to play, family holidays. What's more, the Children's Society has also found some evidence that children's well-being is actually best when they have about the same amount as their peers. Too much or too little, and their well-being suffers. For them to have fulfilling relationships with their peers, they need to fit in with their friends. They need to have the same amount of stuff, roughly. So increases in disparity of wealth in the country are going to increase the inequality and might also have some kind of damaging impact on the relational lives of children and young people. So overall, what we need to know is that welfare reform will increase the number of children in poverty and the inequality of families and households in this country. It's fairly obvious that those increased levels of poverty will have an impact on objective measures of children's well-being, but also interesting to note that it runs the risk of undermining children's subjective experiences of well-being as well, as the quality of their relationships are quite possibly undermined. So, we find ourselves in this situation where welfare reform has been justified through the moral language of fairness and incentivizing work. And we've also discovered some of the impacts of reform, particularly on children in poverty, that look like they're immoral. So we have moral and immoral arguments. How is reform being sold to us on the rhetoric of morality and fairness? When you look at the facts, it seems so unfair. What I want to argue for the rest of this seminar is that the morality that's making reform so popular is based on three pillars. Sometimes articulated, principally not articulated. Sometimes I suspect being held without ever being examined. And I want to suggest that all of those are Christian heresies. I want to argue that the way that welfare reform is being sold to us is by basing it on some very bad theology. And as if for Christians we want to get engaged in these issues, we need to do our theology a little bit better. Let's look at the three Christian heresies, I think, that are behind welfare reform. Heresy one, the first heresy I want to talk about, something I call the secular prosperity gospel. The prosperity gospel, as I'm sure you know, tells us that God does not want us to be materially poor. And if we just live faithful Christian lives, we will see the outcome of that in material blessings. What's more, the converse is true. And if we're blessed, then this must be a sign that we are, in fact, living good and virtuous Christian lives. Our material prosperity is a sign of spiritual virtue. The secular prosperity gospel is the same thing, but without God. The argument runs the same way. We believe that hard work and dedication should lead to a just and a fair reward. And it's often true, and regularly true, that hard work will be rewarded. It's the second part of the argument where it goes wrong. If dedication and application, those virtuous qualities, lead to material comfort, then the reverse must be true. The material comfort, or indeed wealth, must be a sign of someone having moral virtues, hardworking, dedicated. Material wealth then becomes a visible sign of moral virtue, and the more wealth you have, the more moral you are. We end up in a situation where the celebration of wealth rather than virtue can become normal, and the Times newspaper can publish a rich list every year as though being rich would, by definition, a sign that you deserve public acclaim. But then we can extend that argument even further, because if wealth is a virtue, then poverty is a sin. People who are poor, people who are on benefits, are by definition sinful. They're not people who have been unlucky, who've been trapped by the global economy, who've suffered perhaps a personal tragedy, or has just been caught up in a cycle of deprivation, poor education, poor health, poor job circumstances. In the secular prosperity gospel, there is no place for circumstance. Being poor is a sign of sinfulness. And if you don't believe me, I think we can see that playing out in the political and public rhetoric about welfare. Let's look at a few examples first from political leadership. Firstly, we have the first step in that argument, Nick Clegg's Alarm Clock Heroes of 2011, where in that speech to a Liberal Democrat conference, he said that the people who get up and courageously go to work have the potential to save our economy from recession. That's the first step in that logical argument I outlined. Hard work is good. Hard-working people are moral and virtuous. I have no problem with that. But there's a vacuum here about being poor, because no mention is made of the fact that the poor might also be working and would therefore be virtuous. Just a silence into which other political voices can speak. So let's start filling in that silence. Next, we have Ian Duncan Smith. And I quote, "It's madness to support the poorest families if they have more children than they can afford." So here we're beginning to move that argument into the flip side of it, where the poor now become irresponsible and feckless and lacking moral virtue. We're beginning to use the language that suggests that poor people are less responsible and less virtuous. There's no suggestion that people with large families might have got unlucky, might have been made redundant and lost the ability to look after a spouse and children, or had their working hours cut, been made redundant. No, it's because they've been irresponsible and they shouldn't be having families. And just to prove that no political party has a monopoly on ridiculous statements when it comes to welfare, we have this from Labour's Liam Byrne. And I quote, "Let's face the tough truth that many people on the doorstep at the last election felt that too often we were for shirkers and not for workers." And that's that final step in the argument. Because these people are poor and not morally virtuous, then now we can question whether or not they really deserve our support. We must be on the side of the workers and not the shirkers, for the poor are clearly unacceptable. But my two favourite examples of this actually come from the media. James Dellingpole from the Daily Craft said, and I quote again, "The fake disabled are crippling our economy." His argument was that people in receipt of disability benefits were corrupt and cause of our less than robust economy. Not, you'll note, investment bankers, not subprime mortgages, not collateralized debt obligations. No, the fake disabled had driven down our economy. We blame the poor and the vulnerable through their immorality of claiming fake benefits. But I have to give you my all-time winner, which comes from the Daily Mail, their front page headline of the 3rd of April this year, next to a photo of Mike Philpott, "Vile product of Welfare UK, man who bred 17 babies by five women to milk benefits system is guilty of killing six of them." Mick Philpott's crimes were vile, but the suggestion explicit in the headline that being on benefits has caused his immorality is just staggering. It's a new depth where we've described the tool for helping some of society's poorest as being some of the cause of some of its most heinous acts. So if you're sat to someone with next to someone with children at the moment who's probably on child benefit, therefore a benefit claimant, if the Daily Mail is right, they're probably going to turn into mass murderers tomorrow. So when we accept the secular prosperity gospel and accept that being poor is a sin, then what does that do to our attitudes about welfare? If people are only poor because of their own failings and their own inadequacies, do they deserve any support at all? And we know a little bit about that too, because there are questions in the British Social Attitudes Survey where we can look at what people think of benefit claimants. And the way that attitudes to welfare and benefits shift during times of depression and recession. In the course of previous recessions, what's happened is that sympathy for people on benefits has increased as recessions hit. There's been that sense that we're in this together, it could happen to someone I know, and therefore support for generous provision has gone up. In this recession, the opposite appears to be happening. And as poverty has increased and the recession has deepened, people have lost sympathy for people on benefits. The rhetoric of the poor being less virtuous has allowed people to develop less sympathy for them, and support for welfare payments has dropped. That change in attitudes is far from uniform, but it is a distinct trend. There are still, there's some good news, a majority of people who believe that child poverty is an important issue and that the government has a role and a significant role to play in doing something about it. But the overall trends are downwards. 62% of people now believe that unemployment benefits are too high, a fact I'm going to return to in a minute. 80% of people think that large numbers of people falsely claim benefits. Actually, about 1% of benefit money is fraudulently claimed. and even support for benefits for disabled people who are unable to work has fallen to an all-time low of just over 50%. And when we look at some of the figures more closely, you can see more clearly how that rhetoric is beginning to work through in public attitudes. 3/4 of the British public now believe that drug and alcohol abuse are the main cause of child poverty. Actually, about 4% of claimants of the main out-of-work benefits have drug and alcohol abuse problems. But what we see is that language of moral failure being seen as the cause of poverty, and that poverty is not a matter of circumstance or accident, but one of a lack of moral virtue. And that's driving this breakdown in levels of sympathy and generosity for people who are less well off. So Heresy 1 gives us a new paradigm of poor people as less virtuous, less deserving. It's that first brick in a new morality that says we don't have to support poor people through a welfare system. Which brings me on to the second heresy, the idolatry of work. Now, don't get me wrong, I think work is basically a good thing, but I don't think it's an end in itself. I think it's there to serve a function. St. Paul says in Ephesians 4:28, anyone who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, must do something useful with their own hands that they have something to share with those in need. There's a clear injunction that work is a good thing, that we should be working, exercising our creativity and bringing out our potential. But work in Paul's writings is about having something to give back to your community. It's about the life of generous interdependence that we've spoken about already. To be human is to be relational. So I'm all in favour of work. Work is a good thing. What do I mean by the idolatry of work? It's pretty simple. We make things into idols when we begin to suppose that they can do things that are properly the purview of God. And I think we're getting to a stage now where we're idolising work as the solution to poverty rather than part of the solution. The whole thrust of the government debate about welfare reform is the need to get people into work and off benefits, and therefore for them to no longer be a burden to taxpayers. But I think we're crossing a line from work as an aspect of human life that it is good and virtuous, that helps us fulfill our God-given potential, to work as the purpose of human life and the means of our salvation from poverty. The problem with that is that, and again I'm going to take a child-centric view, nearly 2/3 of children in poverty live in working households. Jobs are part of the solution to poverty, but they're not the solution to poverty. The quality of work we have, the amount of work we have, the salaries that people are paid matter too. Low quality, low hours work is not going to solve this. So the problem of seeing work as the solution to everything opens us back up to that issue again we saw with the first heresy. If work is an idol, then worklessness becomes a sin. And again, this fuels that public rhetoric about the skivers who, as George Osborne said, leaves home every morning to go out to work and sees their neighbour still asleep, living a life on benefits. Once again, we set up that distinction between the worthy and the unworthy, this time dependent on who's in work. Those relations on which humanity relies are broken again by a false distinction between worthy working people and unworthy workless people. And what happens next is that we feel we can cut benefits to the worklessness as they're not worthy and not deserving. But there's a huge problem here, in that a large amount of our social security budget goes on supporting people in low-paid work. For example, less than 1/3 of tax credit recipients are out of work. What we don't understand is that we're also penalising hard-working, low-income families. Those people on minimum wage who work part-time, who can only get a few hours and want more, will get penalised out of this false distinction between the worthy and the unworthy, working and workless. And that, I think, is the second plank, a very poor theology we have that's been undermining our belief in the value of benefits and welfare. So what's the final heresy we need to have a look at if we're going to have a more constructive view of welfare reform? The final heresy I want to suggest is a confusion between human fairness, which has been used to justify a lot of this, and divine justice. I'm going to read you a story from Matthew's Gospel, which you will all be very familiar with. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them into the vineyard. And when he went out at about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And he said to them, you also go into the vineyard and I will pay you whatever is right. So they went. When he went out about noon and about 3 o'clock, he did the same. And about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, why are you standing here idle all day? They said to him, because no one has hired us. He said to them, you also go into the vineyard. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and going to the first. When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now, when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received the usual daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he replied to them, friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous? So the last will be first and the first will be last. A lot of the language we've heard about welfare reform has been the language of fairness and fairness to taxpayers. The point about the reforms is they're supposed to be fairer on us, hardworking, earning taxpayers who shouldn't have to fund the lifestyles of lazy scroungers. On top of that, we've already worked out that's an erroneous view of welfare, there's a further problem here. And the problem comes for anyone trying to base an argument from welfare reform on fairness. The problem with the parable of the workers in the vineyard is it is not fair. The reason that the story is offensive, which I suspect is the reason it was remembered and made it into our Bibles, is that Jesus appears to endorse something that's clearly unfair in the social values of the day and the social values of our day. The point is that that lack of unfairness is declared to be a sign of divine justice. The two, it seems, are not the same. And because this story is so obviously unfair, we've tried to tame it down. We've pretended that this is about salvation, something which we do not deserve and yet are given by God anyway. This is really an example of how God relates to us rather than something we need to imitate. But what if it's actually about life too? In order to understand that story, we need to know a little bit more about the day laborers, those people who have no regular work and no regular income. The point about the day laborers is that they lived a hand-to-mouth existence. They had no land with which to feed themselves, no money to fall back with when times were tough. If they did not work, they possibly did not eat. These are the people at the very bottom of the finance ladder of first century Palestine, who are entirely dependent on the whim of employers. So as the landowner discovers labourers throughout the day who have no work, what he was discovering were people who had no way of sustaining themselves, people who would go to bed hungry, and in offering them work, he was supporting people who had no other safety net. Of course, the people who work all day do just what humans do and complain that it's not fair, it's not right, they only worked an hour. Why should they get the same as us? The point appears to be that God's justice operates on the basis of what people need, whereas human fairness operates on what we think people deserve. So we have another corollary with the way that welfare is organised in this country and the way it's talked about. The narrative about welfare that we've been fed is that it needs to be fair. And it's easy to come up with examples of people who seem to be milking the system, who are getting more than their fair share of benefits, who seem to live on our hard work. And those few examples are used to fuel our sense of unfairness. But I want to question whether that's the point. I'm not sure we should be asking if this is fair. We should be asking, is this just? Let's take a concrete example again. One of the acute problems for policymakers is, what do you do about children in poverty? A lot of the rhetoric says that families don't deserve benefit payments if they've acted irresponsibly, but having too many children, or whatever the comment is. But we're then struck by the fact that children have done nothing wrong, so it would be unfair to cut the children off. So we're caught on the horns of the dilemma of saying, are we fair to children? Are we unfair to adults? Perhaps the way to cut through the dilemma is to stop trying to work out if it's fair and ask instead, is it just? Do families need the money to get by? The welfare system's supposed to act as a safety net. It's supposed to go to the people who need it most, not necessarily the people who deserve it. There's an interesting twist on this story as well. If you look at the British Social Attitudes survey, which I mentioned before, what you find is that a lot of the public think that benefit payments are too generous. I mentioned it earlier. They think that people don't deserve the kind of money that they get. However, you can also look at work done by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, where they look at something called minimum income standards. What the Joseph Rowntree Foundation have done is asked members of the general public how much they think different families would need in order to get by. They then calculate a cash value for that minimum income standard, which they can then compare to the amount that people would receive on benefits. Just to give you a sense of how that plays out, if you are a single parent with one child, the amount you would receive in benefits would amount to 57% of what the public think you need to get by. A couple with two children, that's 58%. Just out of interest, if you're single and working age, then that figure is 35%. What we think people deserve, what we think is fair, is a long way from what people need and what we think is just. So what do you have when you put those three heresies together? We have a system that believes that work is the cure to all our ills, that benefit levels should be determined by what people deserve and not what they need, and that many people who are poor don't actually deserve benefits or deserve fewer benefits because they are the victims of their own irresponsibility and immorality. And I think that's part of how we've got into this mess. What we've done is constructed a vision of society that allows us to reduce benefits, that allows us to endorse regressive economic policies, that allows us to use the language of blame in the public sphere and not feel guilty about it because it's fair. What we've done is erode the social bonds of relational communities that underlie a functioning society and what it means to be properly human. So where does that leave us? How can the church get involved and what should it do? It's hard, and I have bad news because I think not a lot is going to change, at least in the next 18 months to the next election. I think the window for the opportunity for influencing welfare reform is closing fast and will remain closed in the immediate future. But that doesn't mean we can't do anything. The first thing we have to do is challenge the public story we're being told about welfare. The kind of language that's used in the public square, and most definitely in the media and across the political parties, should appall us all. And we should stop people letting people get away with it. There are two parts to that issue. The first is moral. It simply shouldn't be acceptable in Christian discourse to use the kind of language that we see about how people are. We know that a minority of people defraud the system. We know that a minority of people make terrible choices. We know that some people behave despicably. But when we use that language to characterize benefit claimants as a whole, we actually tell terrible stories and fall into terrible bigotries. The second part of this argument is that we need to get our facts right. Too often in the public debate, we've generalized from a single appalling case to label an entire group the fake disabled, as I mentioned earlier. And because benefits are so complex, many of us really don't know what the truth is. Time and time again, public polls tell us how little people understand of the complexities of the benefit system. So the next step is perhaps to be a little better informed. If you read the Joint Public Issues Team report, Baptist Union of Great Britain, Methodist Church, Church of Scotland and United Reformed Church, their publication, The Lies We Tell Ourselves, was precisely the kind of contribution to the public debate about getting better informed that the church is well placed to make. The church isn't bound by a 5-year political cycle. We don't have to pander to ill-informed opinions. We have an opportunity to speak truthfully to the issues and to hold people to account when things go wrong. And in the short term, I think we need to hold government to account on whether some of the practical outcomes of reform match the stated ambitions. As universal credit rolls out across the country, we need to see whether it does encourage people into work, not force them back into work because they have their benefits cut off, but support people back into work that makes them better off and is fulfilling. There is a task here for the church to look at the impacts of what happens in welfare reform. But there's one final thing you can all do now if you haven't done it yet, and if you work it out, here comes the advert. You can go to the Children's Society stall in the G-Source and join our photo petition to ensure that all children in poverty get a free school meal. Currently, 1.2 million children in poverty do not, and 700,000 are not even entitled. With universal credit being implemented, the criteria for qualifying for free school meals has to be updated. This is a live political issue, and we can make a difference. So if you've not joined yet, go down, drag your friends along, get them to do it, dress up as a dinner lady, look ridiculous, and tell all your friends about it too. And there are a whole other pile of resources down at the Children's Society stall. In particular, if you want to think a bit more about theology and child poverty, we published this collection of essays in July called The Heart of the Kingdom. There are some copies on the stall. It's available free online to download. Please have a read. Finally, before you all rush off to queue up at our stall and join our campaign, which I know is where you're all going next, you'll find that now when you get down there, there are a number of quotes about child poverty and from children in poverty that we've gathered. Here's just one of them from a young mother, Jack Munro. You may have seen her blog, who's blogged about life on the breadline. She says, "I had absolutely no money left. And my son, then aged 2, had the last Weetabix for breakfast mashed up with just water. When he asked for more, I had to say no. It was heartbreaking." The welfare system we have is one of the last lines of defence against poverty, particularly child poverty. So Jack and her child, and quite possibly people you know, have relied on it and are relying on it. And that means they're relying on us to get that public debate right, and at the moment, we're not. They're relying on us to be better informed. They're relying on us to end the kind of language that blames the poorest for their own poverty. They're relying on us to make sure that the people who need benefits most get them, and get them in the right amount. They are relying on us, and I don't think we should let them down. Thank you.
Nigel, thank you very much indeed for helping us get beyond the headlines and beyond the political sound bites and bringing some theological coherence to welfare reform. And you've made a really great contribution to that debate. Thank you very much indeed. I know we have got a few minutes left to take some questions. I know you're happy to do that.
Yep.
If anyone has some questions, if you can come down to this mic and we'll see how many we can get through.
This is always the scary bit where you ask me deeply technical questions about benefits and I go, I don't know.
Well, thank you. A great talk. But why do 1.2 million children not get free school meals?
The difference is if the 700,000 who are below the poverty line, there are 700,000 who are not eligible. And if your parent or parents work, you lose your eligibility. If you work 16 hours as a single parent, you lose, your children lose eligibility. 24 hours, I think it is, as a couple. So if you're in very low paid work, you can lose your access to free school meals for your children, but still be below the poverty line. The additional 500,000 on top of that, we think is largely due to stigma. Because a lot of schools operate systems where you can tell which children are on free school meals and which aren't. And parents don't want their children to be bullied in school, and kids don't want to stick out. They don't take up claims. So that's the reason.
Thank you for your theology. I think it's very sound. In the food banks and job clubs in which I'm associated with, we get many people coming to us with stories of actually being absolutely destitute because of benefits sanctions. Yeah. I think in many cases this is just administrative mess up or very strict conditions. I'm beginning to think more and more there is a policy of destitution. What do you think about the justice of that?
Wow. That's a tricky, that's a hard one to comment on. I mean, I think we've also done some work with children in the asylum process. And there helped the government helped the APPG run a review on that. And there, the APPG did actually suggest that there was a positive policy of destitution amongst immigrants to try and get them to go back. We return to the wider benefits thing. I'm not sure I've seen enough evidence to know that there's a conspiracy theory. But if you're on the front line, you may have seen more of it than I have. And actually watching those kinds of things will be quite interesting in the evidence we need to talk about the impact of welfare benefits. I think food banks are going to be one of the kind of thermometers of how our welfare system is coping and how much demand there is on them. So yes, I'm not sure, but interesting and one to watch.
Thanks again for all that. You've talked quite a lot and seem to go along with the official line that a lot of these changes are being made in order to get people back into work. But where are the jobs?
Yeah.
And they're getting people back into work that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
For people without qualifications, they don't seem to be able to get jobs because people with qualifications are doing much lower grade work than they're qualified for.
Yeah. One thing I'm not is a macroeconomist. So kind of debates about how to fuel jobs into the economy is something I feel ill-equipped to do. But the disparity between the amount of people who need jobs and the amount of work out there is a huge problem. And how you construct a moral system of welfare reform that gets people into work when there is no work is bizarre. So again, I think you make a very valid point. At the time when there are no jobs in the economy, to be trying to move people into work that does not exist is both bizarre and self-defeating, which would be an additional argument for keeping our welfare benefits system generous until such time. I mean, there will come a time where the economy will begin to improve and jobs can be generated. And then you get into whole big arguments about what kind of jobs, what kind of education, how do we do, of which better macroeconomists than I am can struggle with. But I think you're entirely right. It's ridiculous when there are no jobs in the system to be trying to push people into work that doesn't exist.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's quite depressing, really, that 3 years into the current government, that there isn't a kind of popular uprising against what's being visited upon, well, poor children and many other groups in society. And I would have thought that expected by now that we would have had some serious confrontations between those who are on the losing end and those who are dishing it out, as it were, as there have been in some other European countries. But I just wanted to say that although we see that all the three political parties, the main parties, are more or less in the same place on this, that I've been quite encouraged by the People's Assembly movement, and that there are People's Assemblies cropping up all over the country which are beginning to see ways of opposing on this. And I think it's quite important, if people feel frustrated that there isn't an option for them to express their views at the ballot box, they can get involved in their local People's Assemblies and try and work towards some change.
Fantastic. I mean, I think a lot of the... We haven't seen the full impact, of course, of all of the cuts and benefits coming through. So I think as more impacts happen over the course of the years coming, people will realise the depth of the cuts. And there may be more people who suddenly realise this is a bigger issue. So we may see more of the movement coming on, and obviously as the Children's Society we're working on it, but give us a bit more time for the revolution.
I have a question about the agency of parents and the extent to which parents should be responsible for having a number of children that are that they can afford to have. My housemate and his girlfriend earn between them over £100,000, and so they couldn't afford to have children, and so decide not to have children. So I'm interested in the agency of parents and the importance of that. Mick Philpott, regardless of what else he did, he did have 17 kids.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested in the agency of parents. Related to that, I'm interested in the idea of the welfare state as opposed to the idea of national insurance. So Jack Monro, who you mentioned, used to have a very good job and lost that, unfortunately. She now claims welfare because she used to work but is now finds herself unemployed for a period of time and can't do that anymore. There's a difference, it seems to me, between welfare and national insurance, and the contributory principle, I think, is quite important in underpinning that and in supporting the agency of parents to look after their families. I'd be interested in your thoughts.
I mean, there is no doubt that parents, when it comes to family poverty and household poverty, have significant part to play. But I think what we've done is we've fallen down a line of rhetoric, as I was saying, that has purely blamed the parents and then penalised the children because we've blamed the parents. And reasons why parents have big families are many and varied, and some people do just lose jobs. What you also find is that actually parents, particularly parents of children in poverty quite a lot of time, do an enormous amount to try and shield their children from poverty. The number of parents who go without in order that their children will have is quite huge. And interestingly, some of our research and some of the other research shows the extent to which children do the same thing. They don't bring back the letter from school that says there's a school trip because they know mum can't afford it. So they actually shield their parents. So the way we support whole families through these things, financial advice, debt counselling, those kinds of issues are hugely important. But I don't think at the moment we should be penalising children, even if the agency of the parent is bad.
Thanks for a very interesting discussion. I admit that I don't have the statistics, but I guess my understanding is that raising children in poverty leads to really bad outcomes throughout the lifespan and bad outcomes for society.
Yep.
Do you think that there's an argument to be made that we should support children out of poverty because it's cost effective?
I couldn't do the statistics off the top of my head. There's an essay in this paper, the first section of this collection of essays. One of the essays is on the impact of children now, on poverty on children now. One of them actually does the figures for what's the impact of children in poverty on their future and looks at some of the economic impacts. So I think you can make a moral argument that it's more cost-effective to do things about child poverty now because the outcomes for children in poverty are much worse later in life and much more costly. And some of that's in that essay if you want to look at that one.
Hello, thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed it. But I just have a very simple question. With the research that you guys have done, can you tell me what you have found to be the main factors of why children actually are ending up in poverty?
It really is low quality work at the moment. Not enough jobs out there, very low paid jobs, people on very low hours, minimum wage labour. It really is about the lack of good quality work in the system, single biggest factor at the moment.
Do you think that's a bigger factor than, say, like single parenting?
Yeah.
Thing was that?
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for your questions. And can we thank Nigel once again for his talk? And don't forget to visit the G-Source store.